to the Cozy Impact Pod.
Hello, Malia.
Hi, Julia.
Hi.
Every giggle and every laugh as we start our episodes every single time.
I love it. And I am so excited.
Clapping hands right now.
We're clapping hands. I'm so excited for this episode today. For our friends listening live or joining us later, you are listening to the Cozy Impact Pod. So I invite you into this vision, this environment. We've got soft blanket, abundant plants and nature. We've got a fire in the fireplace and dear friends. You are in your element, feeling energized and nourished by the setting and the sense of community. Welcome to the Cozy Impact Pod. It's a virtual embodiment of this experience where we open the door to topics that impactful people and conscious leaders are constantly thinking about but rarely get to talk about. We destigmatize, play, and laugh our way to a greater sense of belonging for our friends across helping professions, from social entrepreneurs like ourselves to activists, nonprofit and social impact folks, educators, and anyone who wants to contribute to making the world a better place. Welcome home. And this week, we are going to be continuing our conversation about exhaustion and burnout for activists and folks in impact fields with a very, very special guest, Taj M. Smith. And Malia, I know you and Taj have been friends for a bit now, so could you tell us a little bit about Taj before we welcome him in?
Yes! I am so excited that Taj is here with us, because I know that when Julia and I started this podcast, we were thinking about people and minds that we really wanted to have conversations with. And Taj, you just kept coming to my mind again and again and again. I was like, I need to have these conversations. Also, Taj, we've had this conversation of we're going to work together some way, and you don't know how yet, but we're just going to let it happen in its own way. So I'm just planting the seed a little bit more of the ways that we get to collaborate. But Taj and I met doing the Trauma of Money course that we actually talked about in our last episode a little bit. And we just connected in a virtual screen first. Every time that he would say something, I was like, yes, yes. And every time I would say something, Taj was like, yes, yes. And then finally, we got to connect. And I just adore you. And I'm so happy to be here with you. And just a little bit about our guest, Taj. So Taj M. Smith, him, is the founder of Rooted Respite, an online burnout support community serving activists, DEI practitioners, faith-based change makers, and others committed to creating a more equitable world. As a Black transgender entrepreneur, Taj focuses in amplifying anti-oppressive thinking and a worldview dedicated to bringing people back into relationships with themselves, each other, and the land. This is why we get along so much. Taj is a coach, writer, and speaker with a creative passion for music and literature, particularly sci-fi and fantasy. His written work explores the ways sci-fi overlaps with spirituality, justice, and identity to create hopeful futures. His writing appears in Sojourners, Huffington Post, and the Harvard Divinity Bulletin. His own transition story was published in the Austin Hartke's book, Transforming the Bible and the Lives of Transgender Christians. He holds a BA in politics from UC Santa Cruz and an MDiv from Harvard Divinity School. So welcome, Taj.
I'm so excited.
Welcome.
It's so good to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
One of the easiest decisions we could have made. Well, I just wanted to note, when we first hopped on together, we were like, I don't know if I'm feeling so cozy in this Cozy Impact Pod. Taj, where were you yesterday? I want people to know.
I was in Minneapolis yesterday. So here's the trajectory. On Thursday, I woke up in Massachusetts and went to bed in Minneapolis. Thursday, I woke up in Minneapolis and went to bed in Massachusetts. And now it's today.
My brain's confused.
Wait, did you fly back and forth in one day? Is that?
In 24 hours, yes.
Whoa. Oh. That's a lot. You know, sometimes when I see people travel this much, and also I think for all three of us, we're starting to travel more in our careers, which is very exciting. And also, like, there's the balance, right? Like, I remember being a little bit younger and seeing business people on the plane, and that's what they do all the time. And I'm like, whoa, what's that like? Sounds exhausting. And then you realize it is exhausting. And especially when you're teaching workshops or working in conferences or doing things like that, going in person, it's like it takes a lot out of you, that energy.
Yes.
We're all so nodding. All three of us are nodding.
So, and thanks for being here, Taj. And before we jump in, actually, what were you doing in Minneapolis?
So I was presenting a burnout workshop, like a burnout prevention workshop for some HR professionals in co-ops.
So, oh,
yeah,
cool.
Like justice aligned food and food justice. So that was really cool. And it was such a great group of folks and like just such a fun event to be part of. It was really cool to just be able to be there and to like be in this work, in this iteration of like my practice and like what I'm talking about these days.
Oh my gosh. Well, I think that that's a perfect lead into my first question for you, which is, how did you get into this?
Oh, I got into it from burning out myself.
Yeah.
I've had probably, I think it's been about like three episodes of major burnout that I've had. The first coming off the No on Prop 8 campaign in 2008/2009 in California. The second, it just in grad school when I was just, I lost somebody important to me in every year of grad school. And then with just the workload coupled with like having a part-time job and an internship and like all of the other like things that I needed to be doing to take care of my life, like burned out then. And then I burned out again while I was working on the Yes on 3 campaign in Massachusetts. And it was just, it was a lot. And each time I learned something new about myself and about like what I need from a workplace. And I also like, I feel like each instance has something that set it apart from the others. And like little moments and like nuggets of wisdom that I was able to pull out to like help me through the next time I burnt out. But that it wasn't enough to like kind of stave it off. And like this last time, I just felt like, you know, like with the way that our economy works and the ways that people are encouraged to like engage with work, like burnout in a lot of cases is inevitable, especially when like there are like so many workplaces where like boundaries are just non-existent and it's expected that you don't have them. So, you know, we just have to keep adding on to the pile of work and, you know, it's really disheartening to see the pile grow and never get any smaller and never feel like you're accomplishing anything. So, like, you know, I just really wanted to help folks who are doing this like impact work and who got into it because they're passionate about changing the world, like just to like give them some tools to help them set those boundaries and hold those boundaries even if other people aren't going to respect them. Just because, you know, like we need activists, we need advocates and abolitionists and people who are just like lifting up the possibilities for the way that the ways that we live. And, you know, like one of the biggest, I think one of the biggest detriments that like an activist can experience, like through an experience of burnout, is that loss of vision. So like keeping that front and center, keeping the possibilities open. I was just like, okay, this is my work. And I'm like, I love doing it.
Yeah. And you talked about, yeah, well, first, thanks for doing it. Thanks for doing this work, because it's so needed and so important. And like you said, we need the activists, we need the abolitionists, we need the advocates. And I wondered, you know, digging in a little bit more into that, like, what are the issues, the areas in activism that you're especially passionate about, that, you know, you talked about supporting cooperatives working in food justice just yesterday in Minneapolis. Are there issues that you are particularly engaged with in supporting your clients and organizations on?
So, I mean, my activism has all been in like LGBTQ plus rights and like just advancing inclusion for like trans folks, especially. With a little sprinkle of like anti-racism justice in there. That hasn't been the primary focus, but like all of everything I do is intersectional just because of who I am. So like I can't not talk about race when I'm talking about like any other identities. So like I know for like in seeing like the people that I know who do this kind of work and do this kind of activism, who are passionate about it, like they want to stay in it, but they don't know how they can stay in it with the way that things are going.
Yeah. Do you have an example or something that you've seen, whether from your experience, like what actually is happening in that moment, either from your experience or someone else's consenting experience? What is actually happening in that moment when you want to keep going, but you feel like you can't keep going, but you don't know how to work in the way that things are?
Yeah. So it kind of like, at least for me, like it manifested as kind of like this feeling of despair and like feeling like trapped. Because it wasn't that I was trapped in the work, because I loved doing the work, but it was also that like I felt trapped in that I couldn't ask for help and in the ways that I needed help, and that it felt like no matter what I did, that there was still so much to do.
Oh, I feel that.
Yes.
I feel that. And I'm sure other people feel that right now, too.
Yeah, I'm hearing that a lot. And like among people who are just like really adamant about like changing things, you know, like there's this it just seems like every time we open our computers or our smartphones, you know, like there's just this onslaught of headlines, and like it feels like no matter how far we push and like how much work we do, there's still so much inequity and so much like oppression that's happening in around the world, that it can really feel like, you know, we can feel like we're rolling that boulder uphill. And you know, there's only so long you can do that.
I wonder from your personal experience, Taj, now having been through burnout yourself and working with folks to get through it, like what are the kind of day-to-day practices that or you know, perspectives that help you sustain and that you share with others?
Yeah, so the practices, like I have a regular like meditation practice that I do like every night, most nights. I shouldn't like yeah, I might miss a night or two here or there, but like I try to do it every night. It helps me stay connected to like my sense of like being my purpose, but also like stay in my body. Found that for me, like activism that really comes from a place of like wanting to change so often comes from like heavy analysis and relying on like those, like a lot of the theories that I learned in school and like what, and applying these like different, like ways of seeing the world, but like in seeing in like all of the work that I do to see and analyze the world, I never stopped to ask myself how I was feeling about doing all of this work.
How am I feeling about doing this work? Yeah, I love what you're sharing about like this analyzing, seeing. I think especially a lot of people who work in activism or social impact, it's like I see the way the world is. I might not know all the answers, but I see the way that it could be better. Right. I think that's something that drives us. But in the process, how are we tuning into ourselves? How are we creating sustainability for ourselves? And how does that mirror our sustainability for the way that we do things in the world and our planet and everything else?
Exactly. I mean, like I started reading The Four Pivots last night. We were just talking about this. The Four Pivots by Sean Ginwright. He talks about like, and I was just like, oh, those are the words that I was looking for to describe this exact thing. It's like the lens versus the mirror, and using the lens, like having the lens as the analytical perspective, and being able to like apply all those theories and all those things you learned in school, but the mirror is like holding it up to be like, okay, well, what is the truth about my experience in this? And like really like digging into that aspect of it, because and I feel like this is one of the catalysts to like kind of the journey that I've been on through my entire life, like this spiritual journey that I've been on, like to get to some notion of little t truth. And it's like, yeah, like so much of the activist spaces that I was part of, like as a teenager and in college, like they really relied heavily on the lenses. So heavily on the lenses, but not really enough on the mirror. And
Whoa.
like I at the time, like prior to like my going to divinity school and all of that, like I phrased it as like, okay, there's not enough, there's no room for like spiritual growth in this, or like spiritual like investigation. So I really see like that deep, like reflective, like going inward as a spiritual practice, and like so much of the like work of prayer to like to hold that vision of what can be, and to ask for help in manifesting it. So like how then do we turn that like and like take it out of its like religious context, and turn it into something that like religious and secular people alike can use. And like I feel like that notion of lens versus mirror, and like having that self-reflective space and like time to vision and envision the world that we're actually working towards, really plays a big part in that.
I just got chills.
I love that. And I think we're maybe going to hold off until later, but I actually I feel like let's go there, Taj. Like, what is that vision that you hold on to for where we're going and what is possible?
Yeah, that vision involves lots of sleep for everybody. I just want everybody to be able to take naps when they need to take naps, like, and to be able to just like live in the flow of like what their bodies need, and not be beholden to what is driven like by money, basically. Mm. Like by like what we're trying to do for profit. Like, I feel like profit needs to be secondary, or like not even a thought, really. When considering like the kind of world that we need to build, because like it needs to be something connected and compassionate and just really invested in meeting everybody's needs, basic needs, you know, like talking human rights needs, like food, shelter, healthcare, so then that we can actually have the space to sit down and then say like, okay, well, what do I want from this existence that I have?
Yeah, I really hear that there's this this reflection of why we have so much weight in profit and demand. And it really makes me think about survival and how we live in a very individualistic culture, and how this idea of profit in this way is like, you know, we're always trying to meet the bottom line. Right. But I think there was something that, that you were talking about this idea of profit. And I think sometimes I really think about that because we live in a world right now where we have to make money to survive in the way that the systems are set up for us in this moment. And other people need to make money to survive, but other people are not, everyone's not having a lot of equity in that money experience. And also how we are in survival, and also what limitation that starts to create for others. But it is interesting thinking, if you set it to the side, what does that do for our community and collective? And also, how do we survive? Like, I think this is a question a lot of people who are social activists are wanting to challenge decision makers in profitable spaces and organizations. And how do you help challenge this idea?
Oh, that's a great question. And like, I feel like the answer is becoming more. Well, let me stop, because like, the system we live in really keeps us engaged in this like fight for survival, basic survival. And when we're in survival mode, like there's no room to think about possibilities or like what freedom actually looks like or feels like, because we're just scrambling to get those basic needs met. And so like, for me at least, like I challenge this idea by like deciding to live in that world and the mindset, and like really hold the vision that I'm like trying to create with one foot in that vision and one foot like outside of it. So I like holding the door so I can like help people through. But like, you know, if we're so focused on trying to get our basic needs met, it's really, really hard to like look up and actually see that like there is, that we're just like fighting and scrambling and like just trying to survive.
Gripping.
Holding on.
Taj.
Well, from that place, because you talked about keeping, you know, I mean, it's so clear you also serve this role as guide, that I'm like thinking of these incredible, you know, all the many spiritual stories, mythologies, you know, this what it means to be that guide that can bring people between worlds and realities. And it sounds like this is part of how you show up in the world. And I'm curious because I know in your bio, we learned about your work with sci-fi and thinking about, you know, like, I know there's a whole field of Afrofuturism that's so amazing. And so I'd love if you could tell us a little bit about how you got into sci-fi and like, how does that play into your work in activism and fighting burnout.
Yeah, sci-fi is really where I get, like, it's what fuels my imagination and helps me stay hopeful about the future. Sci-fi is the genre that is seeded from the reality that we currently live in, and it's like extrapolated fully into the future, like however many years, eons the author is like envisioning forward. So for me, like, being able to see that, like, there are people who do have that vision and who can like see a way forward, that it's possible. And the more and more sci-fi that I read, especially sci-fi by like Black, queer, and trans authors, like, it's like I get this image of like what the world we're actually working towards looks like or can look like. And like, it helps me stay grounded in that. And so I don't give into the despair of like what's happening right now. Because there are so many reasons why it can be hard to hold on to hope. And like, sci-fi keeps me hopeful. I think the thing that did it for me, like, I've always been kind of a sci-fi nerd. I just didn't really realize it, I think. My mom used to watch Star Trek, The Next Generation, when I was a kid, and she would always call it her grown-up show. And so I was, like, really intrigued by this grown-up show and what happened on it. It's like, and so there were nights where I would just kind of, I would go to bed, but air quotes, giant air quotes, go to bed, and then stay up in the hallway and just kind of watch, which, you know, later watching Star Trek Next Generation as an adult, I'm like, it's totally fine for kids to watch that show.
Yes.
But like, this idea of the Federation and like what the Federation like stands for, and like the idea that there's a future without money and there's a future without prejudice and bias, like, at least on Earth. It seemed really rad.
Just chiming in here, this is Malia. Right around this time, my computer died. So all of my audio that I was sharing was completely cut out. So right around this period of time, Taj was talking about how sci-fi was such a huge influence for how he was able to see the world. And I started asking these questions about what starts to happen when we lose hope, or we lose that spark, or we lose that creativity when the rest of the world feels so heavy and so daunting. So you're going to hear Taj chime back in as my audio clicks back into gear. So enjoy.
It can be really hard to hold on to. And that's one of the reasons why I feel like sci-fi and fantasy like really resonate for me, because like, when I can't hold on to that vision for myself, I can look through other people's visions and then see like, okay, that there, but there is possibility here. Mm-hmm. There are people who are envisioning a world that is different and more equitable than the one that we currently have. And like, that can sometimes be enough. A lot of times it can be enough to like help me reconnect to what my vision actually is. And like, that's the thing that's so insidious about burnout, is that like, it really robs you of that, of the, of that ability to envision and that ability to like imagine and sit with hope. Because like, you know, if you're feeling like time is scarce and like you don't have enough resources to make the changes you want to make happen, then like then the scramble comes, like that stress and the that scrambling feeling comes in with having to like just figure out how you're going to actually like make a change, or like even like eat, you know.
Yeah,
how are you gonna eat the next day? How are you, like, where are you gonna be living, like all that stuff. So
yeah,
I feel like it's art in any sense is like essential for fueling imagination. Like, like I believe that's one of the purposes of it. And like there are specific genres like sci-fi and fantasy where like the whole point of it is to show that there are other possibilities and that the way things are doesn't have to be the way things are. And that in some cases, like that the way things are haven't always been, it hasn't always been like this, and it won't always be like this.
Oh, that is such a powerful reminder, and what a gift from those genres. And I want to come back a little later and like get your recommended book list too, selfishly for me, but also, you know, I think for listeners too. But I also want to ask for folks who are listening, like we're so lucky to have you on, Taj, and you're an expert in this area and have lived through it yourself. Like for those who are listening, who are, you know, who are like, oh shoot, I'm like, I know I'm in the burnout, or like I'm a fast approaching it. Like what is sort of step one when you realize you're like running on fumes, you're past your breaking point a little bit?
Like step one is acknowledging it and really like looking at it, which is sometimes the hardest part, the hardest step to take. Just because like, I know I'm a recovering perfectionist and a recovering overachiever. And in the peak of my overachieving, like it was really, really difficult for me to admit that I couldn't do all of the things, because I felt like I should have been able to do all the things, because maybe this person over here was doing all of the things, but that person over there also had so much help. So like acknowledging that you can't do all the things and then acknowledging that you need help, like those are the first two steps that are most important. And then finding that help, be it like from a support network, like from like your friends who might be willing to like help you meal prep, or like meal prep for you, or like help you clean your house over the weekend, or like whatever like small thing that you need support with, that they can help take off your plate. Like that is like critical. And I think that for it can be like, especially when burnout sets in, it can be really hard to see that people actually want to help. I know for me it was really, really difficult to see that, like to see and then accept the help that was offered to me. And then even if I, when I couldn't necessarily see it, then when people would actually like offer to help me, then to be able to accept it. So like in those moments when I could acknowledge like, okay, I can't do all the things. Okay, I need help. And then was able to reach out and ask for it, or able to see that somebody was making an offer and then for me to like take them up on it. Like those were the moments in which I felt something shift, in which I felt something lighten up for me. And really realized that like support is so crucial in this work. Like we can't do any of this alone. We're not meant to. Like human beings are, we're social. We're social social beings. And the world that we live in now had like the 40-hour work week and the ways that like the working world was structured. It was structured with the assumption that you would have somebody full time at home to manage the house, manage the kids while you were at work for 40 hours a week. But, you know, these days, like people who share households probably are both working. And like with the cost of living being what it is, like it's harder and harder to actually have that time to take care of all of the things that we need to take care of. And without that support network, it's really, really, it can be really easy to feel, to fall into that, like feel those feelings of isolation and that despair of like, okay, well, like I'm never going to get out of this. But like, you know, there are, what I learned in my, through my own experiences is that like, there are always people around who want to help. And, you know, sometimes they just need to know what the need is.
Mm-hmm. What about prevention? Like, you know, exploring, okay, I am in this state of burnout. I need help. Acknowledging, getting support, resources, reaching out. But what about how do we support ourselves leading up to that moment so that moment doesn't happen? Or and if it does, we have the tools.
Yeah, I think that moment of prevention, like because burnout happens gradually, right? So like it can be hard to see at first because it can feel like the symptoms that people are most likely to notice are like the physical ones of like that exhaustion, the tiredness, not being able to focus, all that stuff, which can also like it can feel like a bad day. Mm-hmm. But like really, really taking the time to sit with yourself and say, like, am I having a bad day? Am I having a series of bad days, or is this something else? Mm-hmm. And to like really listen for what comes up for you. Cause like our bodies are so wise, you know, they are so wise and they will often tell us what we need. And it's our minds that are like, no, you don't need that. No, you can push through.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, like my body tells me to rest. And if I don't rest, then it forces me to rest.
Yeah.
By like making me sick or giving me an anxiety attack or like plunging me into a depression, something like that. You know, like there are so many ways that our bodies like will give us the signs and tell us like, hey, you need to slow down. And then just the hard part is actually looking at that and saying like, okay, I hear you. I'm going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think too, it's like that feeling that can emerge from guilt or shame. Like, oh, well, if I stop, I'm not good enough, or I'm not, you know, we've talked about this before, when other people's lives are at stake or jobs are at stake or the planet is at stake. Mm-hmm. You know, that feeling of rest can feel like I am not doing what I need to be doing. in this world.
Right. Like that's so true. And like, it takes the realization, like for any change maker, I think, like, you can't make change if you're too exhausted to move. You can't make change if you are dead. And like, yeah, you can't make change if you are dead. And like, the way that this economy is structured, you are like, the capitalism will work you to death if you let it. So like, taking care of yourself, of your body, of your it is a critical and crucial part of this work, and in also of like bringing about that world that we envision, especially if that world is one that is slower, is more connected, is more compassionate and self-aware. Self-awareness starts with you. And so like, having the awareness around like what you need and what you can and cannot do, like, I think for me, like, one of the hardest things, especially in my episode in grad school, was figuring out like how much I actually could do versus how much I wanted to be able to do. And like, there was a wild discrepancy between like, I'm just like, oh yeah, I can write these 5 papers and preach that sermon and volunteer, get my volunteer hours in 1 week. Yeah, that's totally doable. Like, it might be doable for someone else. It was not doable for me. Yeah. And I think like, that recognition and being able to say like, okay, well, even though that person might be able to do that, like, I personally cannot do that in a way that allows me to stay healthy. So like, let me figure out what I actually can do and what I do need, so I can figure out how much time and how much lead up time I need to be able to get everything done. And so that way I can prioritize the things I have to get done, and as well as the things I want to be doing.
Yeah, I do have one question or one story, short story about this. It was a workshop I was in, and I remember we were exploring different questions actually through clown play and characterization and theatrical work, which was so fun, and with the pandemic players. And the question that was asked is, in what ways do I show up in the world as an activist, a change maker, a social impact or sustainability person, where I utilize colonial and white supremacy tactics? And I was like taken away by this question, and we played with it through our bodies, that question of, in what ways do I show up where I'm making change for good, but I am still using the same limiting, perfectionist, capitalistic, white supremacy, suppressing systems on either on myself or on other people. And I hear what you're saying is, you know, like you said, we can't keep going if we're dead. We can't keep going if we're tired. And this idea of what ideas of these systemic pressures am I also placing on myself that I am applying to the things that I very much want to change?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And like, yeah, I think one of the really like obnoxious and annoying pieces of capitalism that I had to just like let go of was the idea of standardized expectations. Like, ooh. I'm of a generation where like in school, standardized tests for everything. And like my high school graduation depended on my results of a standardized test. Like I've never been a good test taker. Never been a good test taker. So why on earth would I think that the standards that apply to capitalism are going to work for me? Like, why on earth would I think that? So like releasing those expectations and like redefining what success looks like for myself and like what actually is important, and putting systems in place that get me closer to those things was really the like a turning point for me.
Yeah, I love that challenge to capitalism too, that like it's kind of an activity for all of us, for anyone listening, to really think about how can we relinquish, how can we stop believing that capitalism gets to dictate what we have capacity for and what is a realistic expectation, and those pressures around productivity too, that, you know, are just so ever present. How can we actually challenge those and start to listen in as a first step? And I also think you've talked a lot, Taj, about kind of compassion and collective care. And one of the pieces that comes to mind as you're talking, Malia, about the amazing sounding clowning practice, I'm terrified of clowns, but that sounds so cool, is also
dressed as clowns.
Oh, good. Okay, great. I love that. Is like, I remember for me, as I was getting interested in activism and social impact, social justice work, I definitely came up with a sense of white saviorism. And so much of that comes from, you know, roots of colonization, of the experience benefiting from white privilege and feeling like I deserve to see myself in positions of recognition for impact work, and like so much around ego and personal, you know, reputation. There's so much baked into that. And one of the things that I think I've really shifted around is also like trying to remove myself a little bit and seeing how like there is no one person who's going to end climate change. There's no one person who's going to stop the horrific train of anti-trans legislation in this country. Like there's no one person who can do all of that anywhere. And recognizing that it is, you know, small and big acts by many hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who are moving things in the right direction through their collective effort and energy. Like that's the only way actually we create that change.
Yes. Yes. Like the burden of saving the world never falls on one individual. Like, I was reading this book, Unlearning Shame, by Devin Price, where he talked a lot about systemic shame and how, like, capitalism uses systemic shame and, like, to shame people into, like, making their consumer choices align with their, like, shame and guilt at not feeling like they're not doing enough. And so like, you know, like I don't know if you were a kid in the 90s or if you were a kid in the 90s, chances are like you grew up like all about recycling and I'm just like, I feel so much shame when I throw a can away. But like, you know, me recycling is not going to change the fact that there are corporations that are like responsible for like putting billions of harmful chemicals and like compounds into the atmosphere every day. Like,
yeah,
my individual recycling efforts are not going to offset that. And also like only like 10% of what people try to recycle is actually recycled.
Totally. And we know now also that that was a concerted effort by those companies that were the biggest contributors to climate change and pollution to take the burden off themselves and put the spotlight on individual behavior change, which was super successful, right? Like they, it still happens. I went to my stepdaughter's play and she's part of like a pretty cool like STEAM theater program. And they were learning about climate change in their theater production and had everyone write like, what's one thing that you do to stop climate change? And I wrote on the board that like everyone in the audience could write on. I was like, fight the corporations who are causing it, like legislate. But it is coming back to that, right?
Yeah, it's coming back to like shifting our focus and not like taking responsibility as individuals for what has been done and like what these corporations are doing. And like, but also like individuals coming together to hold these corporations accountable can be like effective. So like my individual actions, like I still recycle, of course.
No shame.
Yeah. You know, like Captain Planet is a hero. But like also knowing that like I do these little actions. They might help in one way, but like knowing that when I am in community with other people who are passionate about this and who are going to put the pressure on the people who can actually make the change and like build that sort of collective power to put pressure on them. Like that's when I know like, okay, like, that's the change is actually possible. But like I try to give myself grace wherever I can.
Give the grace. You know, this makes me think a lot, and this continues to come up in our conversations around social media and how, you know, we talk about the benefit of spreading messages and word through social media. And just being able to share a topic, share information, like this is really powerful to be able to share it. And also at the same time with that sharing, because we're looking at a surface, we're looking at social media, we don't always know how to respond to that sharing. Meaning, if like someone's sharing, like, you need to do more, you need to do more, you need to do more. And then maybe you are doing more, but you keep reading that message, you need to do more. You're like, wait, am I still not doing enough? Am I still like, I feel like I'm doing enough, but now I'm doubting myself. Like, am I doing enough? And I feel like I need to rest because I'm starting to get anxious about this, but then maybe I'm not, but maybe I should step up. And then people shut down or people fight more. Yeah, I'm curious, before we start wrapping up, big question, what about that? Just leaving a big question.
She's like, wow, now I know how my therapist feels every week. Here's this huge thing. We have 2 minutes. But yeah, like, really wrestling with, like, I'll speak for myself in this, because like this is a growing edge for me and something that I am consistently working on. Like I am enough. And one of the biggest ways of one of the capitalism thrives on individuals having low senses of self-worth, so that then they will buy things to then help them feel whole. Mm-hmm. So in those instances, when I feel like I'm not enough or like I'm not doing enough, I really have to stop and like remind myself that like, well, I certainly can't do more. I am enough. What I'm doing is enough. And then just having faith in the fact that like there are other people who are just as invested and just as committed to this vision, who are also doing enough, and like everybody together doing enough, doing what they can do. It accumulates into something that actually is enough.
I love that. Yeah.
Well, I think that was the perfect last question to close on.
Yes. Well, I want to ask one quick one, which is, Taj, where can people go to learn more about you and work with you?
Yeah, they can go to rootedrespite.com or find me on LinkedIn. It's just my name as the link, Taj M. Smith. Yeah, you can stay connected with me.
Thank you so much for being here. And I'm just so excited to see what's going to emerge from this conversation. And also just that feeling of, if we all acknowledge and listen to our bodies and understand where our enoughness is, then we all can do enough. Mm-hmm. But if we really push ourselves into that sickness or death or anxiety attacks, and or we freeze and do nothing, that limits the evolving mycelial growth of change.
Mm-hmm.
Bringing this back in.
We talked about mushrooms
right before we started recording.
Taj, thank you so much.
And
thank you for having me.
Yes. And we're just so excited to see what's going to happen.
Yeah, we're going to get up to some good trouble in the future.
Good
trouble. Thank you, John Lewis.